Good morning, everyone. We hope you're having a great start to the day. We hope you can get your juice to talking about art as we do every other Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. We hope you enjoyed Meg very early in this morning with the eclectic music she has. It's amazing. We hope you enjoyed Rise Up this morning. This show brings out the kid in me every time. It's a program for young and old alike. This is Tom Xenakis, and I'm with Sheila Blake, and we are the hosts of the Artist Experience radio show.
Good morning. Artist Experience is an hour-long radio show dedicated to looking at art. We hope that Tom and I can introduce our listeners to what we've been looking at and help you when you visit the exhibit, create in your soul, in your experience, your own work of art. The Artist Experience radio program has a unique mission. We look into the inward experiences of engagement with art, and we desire to make them explicit, both in the creator and in you, our listeners.
Well, today we have a program. It's titled The Generosity of Art. It sounds like we're going to get a bit philosophical here today about this topic, which is very important to us in the Artist Experience radio program. What is generosity? Do we think about that often? It could be defined as the quality and not quantity of being kind. Synonymous words to generosity can be words like goodness, giving, benevolence, unselfishness, charitable. Well, now it sounds like we can get into maybe a more theological discussion, but I'm going to stay away from that as much as I can, but it's going to be kind of hard. But might I ask you all, what does art give you? Let's think for a moment. What does art give to you? All kinds of art. What does it share with you? The painting on a wall, the great music you listen to here at WOWD, the poetic words of your favorite rapper or performance artist. The art you possess is a product, whether it is a ceramic, a handmade textile, the drawings your kids did at school. What qualities do they have to enhance your being and your essence? How do these objects reflect who you are, and how do they share with the people you commune with? If you're an artist yourself, how do you to give art? Do you share it to the world around you? Do you have a great singing voice, but you only sing in the shower? Do you love to doodle and draw, but you only keep it in a diary and some private sketchbook without showing others? These are philosophical questions that are particularly important today as the arts are being squeezed by the times and the turbulence around us in our as we prioritize our lives, and that's not always good.
Today, I want you to introduce you to Glenn Stone. Glenn Stone is a world-class museum and a world in itself. Everything about it is designed to give us, and I mean you, me, and everyone else, a nearly perfect experience of looking at art. I've been to many museums, and maybe the Fondation Mate in the south of France comes close, but Glenn Stone is a wonderful place. It's marvelous. It's sublime. It's out of this world. It's the reason people love to travel, to be in an environment for pure pleasure, a place with no distractions and no worries because you're on vacation. It's a place that opens your mind to light. So after much anticipation, this new museum opened this week. They added 50,000 square feet to the already existing museum, and it's situated on 230 acres. Meadows with grasses, wildflowers, mature trees, rolling hills, as far as the eye can see. The work being exhibited draws from not only the artists, the giants of American contemporary art, but from work that showcases major movements in art history, including the 1960s in Japan, the 70s in Brazil, and the 1980s in Germany. It's a place that's designed to help you experience the pleasure of art, and it's here, right in Potomac, Maryland. Because of this radio show, I was able to join the media event before the official opening of the museum. My husband, Peter, came with me, and he'll be with us on the show today. We drove out on an overcast, warm Friday morning. Once we got off 270, it was a pretty winding drive. When we arrived, we were told where to park, even the parking lot. Instead of having lines, it had small stones to mark the spaces, and it had trees that are going to get bigger to shade your car. See, it's already pretty perfect. And then we went to the arrival hall where we were served coffee and pastries and given a press packet. Everything that they do is a tasteful, perfect gray. And then there was an 8-minute walk to the pavilions that's calming, a path through wild grasses and a bridge over a restored stream with water plants. Birds are flying overhead. So much has been written about Glenstone, but my favorite description was that the buildings are like ghosts. They're gray blocks of cast concrete with small variation of grays, and they're there and they're not there. So, Peter, do you want to take over?
Well, it's interesting that you described the experience in terms of travel. That's what struck me. After we crossed over the brook, we found ourselves in these rolling meadows, seeing a giant sculpture looming over the horizon. And I felt as I did in Avebury, England, walking with our grandson by ourselves through open wildflower meadows with ancient stones standing upright. A sense of awe is there. And back at Glenstone, as we stroll slowly, staff in modern gray uniforms stride by, busily greeting us, cheerful welcome, so friendly. And then the pavilions come into view, modern gray blocks with a hint of an Italian hill town or pagan stones, but clearly the creation of a contemporary architect. Then when we arrived at the entrance, we were drawn over to the side to a lookout over a low courtyard below us, as level and uniform as a pond, into which a long zip had been placed, or perhaps it's erupting from below into the surface, an earthquake-sized gap in the ground. It's two steel surfaces in single curves, 75 feet long, curving toward each other with space between them, diminishing toward the center where they meet. What is it? How is it made? You guess, or learn from a uniformed guide standing nearby. It's a work by Michael Heiser. A profligate use of space. Nothing in this courtyard but the smooth, pure, unearthly slit in the ground. It doesn't make sense. But you do sense the presence of powerful forces held in balance. The force of earth weight, which bent the steel plates. The work has no references. It provides no revelations, just questions. But the questions are so big.
And you're right about that at the Glenstone. The generosity of art has been promoted so much in the history of the world. But I just want to give our listeners just some examples. Historically, there's a correlation between culturally important times and the generosity of art. And this show is really wants to bang that home, how people could be generous with art. They actually go hand in hand in the history of humankind. Just three examples, like in the golden age of classical Greek art, when the Greeks had just defeated the invading Persian Empire in the late 580s BC, they were absolutely economically wiped out in these years and years of wars. And the Athenians and the other Greek city-states, they took whatever resources they had to make art and to share it with the people. The Greeks in Greece were, and beyond Greece, they wanted to say, hey, you know, we just, you know, want a war. We're kind of poor, but let's get back to, you know, the really cultural things like making art. So they made the Parthenon and the Acropolis as one example. And this move was political, but it was also cultural, on how a statement of how art can declare the power of the people and the power of bringing people together in a unifying way. And I think this is what art does, and that's what that's great for our humanity and our generosity. And the great patron of Islamic art was Suleiman the Magnificent of the Ottoman Empire, and he ruled from 1520 to 1566, and he got this multi-ethnic empire of the Ottoman sphere to make art on all levels of society. This was a great period of generous art making and the spread of Islam. The ceramic arts, architecture, painting, textile arts, dance, poetry, the list goes on and on. This culture was absolutely fueled by Suleiman's generosity. The vibrancy and vitality were mixed, and it was all virtuous stuff. Well, then lastly, of course, we have the Renaissance, beginning in Italy in the mid-1400s, which was an explosion of human imagination, innovation, experimentation, where the boundaries of art and science spread throughout the European continent like a wildfire, and it was stimulating a host of artistic and scientific growth. The church, of course, was being the great powerhouse source of giving at the time. Obviously, things have changed since. But the Renaissance was the absolute cauldron of art and generosity from the 1400s to 1550. There are many other great examples that do this, but we like to share them. We have on the Artist Experience radio program. Sheila, this generosity is enigmatic. But does money and generosity have to go hand in hand? This is something that I was curious about in defining culture and art. Is that kind of question a little too cynical? What do you think?
Well, I'm going to try to address this as what I have to say, because pure and simple, Glenstone is a gift. It's like that old saying, don't look a gift horse in the mouth.
Yeah, right. It absolutely is a gift.
So, and just as I was writing my notes for this show on Thursday, I received this email from Glenstone. It says, "Dear Sheila, we've been dreaming for years about this day. Now at last it's here. The artworks are installed, the buildings are complete, and the 230 acres of rolling meadows, woodlands, and streams have been restored and renewed. With all this integrated into a single seamless experience, we're able to pull back the curtain and reveal the new Glenstone starting today, October 4th. We're deeply grateful to everyone who has worked with us to create the new Glenstone, the great artists who have given us their trust and collaboration, the magnificently talented architect and landscape architects Tom Pfeiffer, Adam Greenspan, and Peter Walker, and our dedicated professional staff. We also thank you, our wonderful visitors, neighbors, and friends who have shared in our excitement and for whom we've built the new Glenstone. It's been a long journey since 2006, and we opened our first museum building, the gallery, designed by Charles Guathmey. 12 years later, having added our new 204,000 square foot building, the pavilions, increased our indoor exhibition space sixfold and more than doubled the landscape available to explore. We invite you to encounter Glenstone as we've always meant for it to be experienced. We hope you will come to stroll the grounds, join an outdoor sculpture tour, converse about art with the guides in our new galleries, relax by the lushly planted water court, or enjoy our cafes. We've been excited by the initial interest in seeing the new Glenstone and understand it may be a few months before reservations are available for the day you would like to visit. But please know, Glenstone's art, architecture, and landscape will be here for you in perpetuity and will always be free of charge. We're looking forward to welcoming you to the new Glenstone. Yours, Emily Way Rails and Mitchell P. Rails, the founders." Well, Solomon Guggenheim, Paul Mellon, J. Paul Getty, Norton Simon, they have never written me a letter inviting me, welcoming me to their museums.
Oh, that's pretty good, Sheila. Well, I have to say, you know, I have never gotten a letter of that sort from anyone else but the Rails. I received the letter as well, and I actually was blown away. I had to read it twice. I wasn't sure if they sent it to the right guy, but it was very tasteful and very inviting. Sometimes I think we put too much emphasis on the relationship between generosity, money, and art, and I think that's problematic. So this is just pure generosity, I think, in the Rails' wonderful invitation. The experience of art does not have to necessarily come with a great price tag. And Sheila, I was mentioning about this friend who, you know, he was very poor. He had, you know, very modest means, and I went to his house in rural North Carolina, and he had all these posters of Van Gogh and Monet, and they were really good posters. And I was kind of curious, like, you know, why all these posters? There was quite a few. It filled his whole house. And he says, "Well, I want my friends to come and enjoy the art that I actually have never seen." He'd never been to the Metropolitan Museum, or he'd never been to Paris. But he knew that they were beautiful for him. And to me, that's a really generous thing in a very simple way. So that's where money really has nothing to do with generosity of art. You know, we sometimes get too cynical about that. And we're so fortunate here in the D.C. metro area with this example of generosity in the rails.
Well, art and especially contemporary art is Mitchell and Emily Rail's passion. Creating this environment was expensive. It cost $200 million. Now, I want to say that we had mentioned this on an earlier show about Glenn Stone, but at some point, Mitchell Rail's had an epiphany, and he decided he did not want to be the richest man in the cemetery. And so this is a product, Glenn Stone is a product of his and Emily's vision. They say they're not leaving a lot of money to their children. This is it. They don't want to leave anything, any money when they die. They're doing this.
Wow, that is so incredible.
It is so great.
This day and age.
So the Rails understand that it's a mind-opening experience, that the environment in which you encounter art must be carefully prepared, and they've done that. That takes money, and it's not opulence like Versailles or like Trump Tower. It's a quiet place where nature prepares you for seeing. There's one gallery that is simply a vast window of amazing non-reflective glass looking out onto the fields with a graceful bench inviting you to experience nature. And nature isn't cheap either. Once Peter and I went to Cézanne's home in the south of France to walk the paths that he painted from, and there was a railroad track to walk next to industrial buildings in the distance. Part of the Impressionist success was that they were able to capture a bucolic, disappearing landscape as industry was taking its place in the landscape. And so part of the Impressionist success was that they were preserving this vision of the past. The Rails investigated and traveled to 50 museums around the world, and they synthesized their experience and knowledge with the architects and landscape architects in order to create this space. Their house overlooks the property, and they take immense pleasure in sharing their creation with all of us. I implore you to please set aside petty grumbling about tax write-offs and wealth and needing reservations. Come on, the whole experience of crowds in museums with cell phone cameras wrecks even the most devoted viewer. The reservations are designed to eliminate those awful situations. This experience is designed to slow you down. A whole gallery room is designed for one work of art or four works by one artist.
Well, I think, you know, this Glenn Stone Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art is a place that exemplifies the title of this entire program that we've been doing, like, for 60 shows, the Art as Experience radio show. The Glenn Stone is much more than a museum. It's an environment. I like to use the word sanctuary. I mean, I think this is really important for the Glenn Stone, where nature, the highest form of art, in my opinion, is nature. But it's synthesized so beautifully with art and humanity. Humanity in all of us, and it's like comes together to embody this experience. Your generous invitation to this special environment is a joyous concept that shares experience. Experience implies the senses. The stimulation of the senses leads to a sensual experience, and the Glenn Stone generously and beautifully lays it out for you. This invitation of engagement is unparalleled in our area and rare in the visual arts in general. Remember, you are coming to their home. You know, that's really an important thing in this case. It's their home. And this is a great thing. You know that expression that you hear in many cultures, mia casa, you know, sua casa, I don't know if I got it right, or tua casa, I mean, tua casa, my house is your house? It's really true. Well, let's face it, when we're generous, we feel good, and we go beyond yourself, and we're going to have a couple of songs here, one an old favorite of mine from Joe Cocker, and then the one from the 80s that we all really loved, by Roxy Music and Brian Ferry. Let's listen in.
You are so beautiful.
Oh, thinking of. Can't you see? Love is a doggone hook in me. Get that buzz. Love is the dog I'm thinking of. Can't you see? Love, the drug for me.
Music just make you feel like getting in your car and driving out into the countryside of
Potomac. And Glenstone, yes.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Really. So there are so many things about Glenstone that make it special. As far as I can tell, thoughtfulness and nothing spared to the last detail exemplifies the Glenstone. This includes an internship program. Aside from a school program with Montgomery County, the Rails instituted an internship program. They employ young people to serve as guides. It's equivalent to a graduate degree, except the guides are paid a living wage. They get health insurance and a study day to explore their interests. And when they've completed this two-year program, they're not saddled with debt, avoiding a class selectivity to who becomes museum staff and curators. Guides are responsible for warmly welcoming visitors, delivering authentic, consistent information about Glenstone's mission, their core values, their collections, the campus, and programs that they've learned through intensive training, and engaging visitors in a dialogue about art, architecture, and landscape. The guides have a genuine enthusiasm for art, architecture, culture, and sustainability, and are passionate about working with people. They're intellectually curious and intuitive with exceptional communication skills. They are trained in Glenstone's inquiry dialogue method of engagement. That was very interesting to me because it really, that when you ask the guides about themselves, they are very, really ready to talk about, they don't all have degrees in art or undergraduate training in art. It's the kind of people they are, the curiosity, that they love conversation. It's not a canned speech like when the docents come up to you in a museum and they say things like, and what do you feel when you're looking at this? And you want to say, I'm not 12 years old.
Yeah. Now, they're so engaging.
They are. They
I mean, they go right for the soul and the jugular of your love for art. It's amazing.
So the guys wear gray uniforms, so not to distract from their surroundings. Although there was a friendly and really knowledgeable guy with bright red nail polish, and he showed me, because I asked him, this great tattoo of a paintbrush that was on his forearm. It was beautiful. He said, I'm so proud, it's my first tattoo. And they seem to be giving you their own personal experiences with art as well as information. So like there's this room with a propped lead piece by Richard Serra and a poured aluminum piece on the wall by Linda Benglis called Wing. That is like a painting that becomes three-dimensional because the material just flowed off the wall. Or these Eva Hesse black sausage-like pieces that are made out of rubber tubing, resin, and fiberglass. The guy said he thought of it as the execution room.
That's pretty good.
I asked him, you can't let children run around in this room. And he says, no, we don't allow children under 12 in the
room. Yeah, because there was.
Well, you know, yeah, I know. It was like, Sheila, you were so excited about this press experience and the briefing last week and you know, introducing the new galleries. But your enthusiasm really impressed me. And I couldn't attend, but, you know, every time you go there, just the overwhelming generosity is so out there. And as an academic, you know, I got to say, you know, I have to plug this in, but there's a lot of learning aspects of the experience. Yes. You know, you're looking at art, but you also learn so much. And that's really important in any experience. You got to surrender to the beauty and the art that the Glenstone, you know, gives you. And I think in that sense, when you surrender to it, your experience kind of exponentially is greater. Sheila, why don't you kind of share that experience in another way about, you know, that generosity?
Well, there were no reservations being taken by the time I went online to get them, so I emailed them about our radio show, and I was immediately invited to attend the media event. And from the very start, everyone, including Mitchell and Emily Rails, greeted you as if they were ready for a birthday party. And they're, and when we arrived, they're yelling like, "They're here!" There were many people from many publications wandering around, as well as a busload of media people brought down from New York. And the next week, there were spreads in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Washingtonian Magazine, and of course here at WOWD, our Artist Experience Show. At the end of the tour, one of our guides asked me what I did, and I was a little bit embarrassed because I was outclassed by some of these other people. And I said, well, I do this radio show on WOWD, it's a community radio station. And she was really excited, and she said, "Please let local people know about this." I got the impression they were afraid that people wouldn't make the trip. Well, let me say, the museum is open 4 days a week, Thursday to Sunday. Reservations are easy to make online. Right now there's a lot of interest, so it might take a couple of months, but they do have cancellations and possibly same day cancellations, so you can get admitted if you try it from your cell phone. There are two cafes, and from the lunch we were treated to, the food, which was farm to table, was excellent. The chef was there as we helped ourselves to seconds.
The involvement of resources and human power to create this expansion are impressive. You know, the environment is an important part of this experience, and the Rails were meticulous and thoughtful about the synthesis of the natural environment around their property. You know, trees removed, and I'm talking about mature trees. That concept is just mind-blowing. These are huge trees that were moved. And the earthworks and plantings were so part of the mentality of the whole visual and natural balance of the Glenstone. There are meadows, forests, a sinuous lake, streams, pools. The expansion includes an environmental center which highlights the Glenstone's organic and sustainable horticultural priorities. I mean, now where do you get that at a museum? The comfortability of the landscape during your visit is melded wonderfully into the design and the development of these new pavilions, which is a complex of the expanded gallery spaces. Designed by Thomas Pfeiffer and partners, the new galleries are tasteful in scale and materials, and they fit the landscape regally. Amid the pavilions is this water court, which is an aquatic garden, again, tastefully done with thousands of plants, and that are actually designed, this I thought was really interesting, they're designed to die in the winter, but they regain their vitality in the spring through a water circulating system. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, that's a very thoughtful thing. And here's where the word sanctuary kicks in. Who does not like a water lily pond? Think about it, you know. You're there to meditate and be pensive about the beauty of art and the generosity of it all. And, you know, the occasional ribbit from the frog ensures that you have been brought to a higher place, and the Glenstone provides this.
Well, they are dedicated to sustainability. They have restored streams. They've planted many varieties of native plants and wildflowers. They don't use any herbicides or pesticides. During the landscaping phase, they restored woodlands, planted more than 6,000 trees of 55 native species. They've moved one of those trees, had a 19-foot root ball in 90 feet in diameter that Tom was talking about. The land was originally a hunt club, but Glenstone was able to acquire a lot more land, I hope through offers the homeowners couldn't refuse. I have to say that you do worry.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, I've been to several homes of famous collectors, and you know, collectors also here in the area. And, you know, it's a very different, you know, feel, you know, when you go to someone's home, you know, and see their art than a museum. It has a total different sensibility. And, you know, the Rails have collected big names in the art world. The list is extensive, and the new expansion houses a Willem de Kooning, a Mark Rothko from the Abstract Expressionist era. You know, additionally, there are works by Jasper Johns, Andy Warhol, Robert Rauschenberg, which represents more of the pop era, which many of our listeners might be familiar with. There's a nice international mix of artists also in the new spaces, which I think is really beautiful. And again, we have to talk about this nature. The natural light in the galleries is a great addition in looking at the art. Natural light is the artist's best friend. And here at the Glenstone, expansion has created the opportunity to look at art in natural light settings.
Yeah, well, you know, any art collection has a definite bias toward the collector's taste. Like when the Hirshhorn first opened in Washington, it was one man's collection. And before they were able to sell and acquire different art, it was clear that Joseph Hirshhorn had a definite bias towards pink and brown.
I never crossed my mind.
Yeah, you did mine. And he would buy a whole room full of artists' work, and not necessarily the finest art. He just says, I'll take the room. Well, the Rails, well, they know what they're looking for. The pieces are not always the latest or the showiest. They have a Frank Stella black stripe painting from 1959, which was the beginning of Frank Stella's handsome works. But it was very, at the time, it was really a very, what do you call it? Like it was a ballsy thing to do, these big black stripe paintings. And yet they are now, through looking back at time, some of his finest work. And they have the de Kooning is about the most beautiful de Kooning I've ever seen. And it's standing, it's right next to a Giacometti. And the gesture of the Giacometti, which is called man pointing, is gesturing over in the same way to the de Kooning, in the same way that the de Kooning gestures. They're just playing each other back and forth. So there's really placement is such an important thing, and they have that down. And there's also a chronological order, not to each painting, but to the movements of painting, so that there's learning going on right there. There's a very considerably small Pollock that's like a painted dance. Oh, it's beautiful.
That's terrific.
And the Rauschenberg, my God, the Rauschenberg was apparently, because of I know from the guides, made for television in Japan. He made this on the spot, and they have it, and it's a great piece. So they also have a book. It's called the Glenstone Field Guide, and it's a very short, kind of nicely, cutely illustrated, written. They've written a piece on each artist and a diagram of the progression of modern art. It's really well done, and it's light, and it's informative.
Oh, it's a terrific little publication.
Isn't
and it's you know, it's this little Bible of, you know, the Glenstone, and I have to say that it's well illustrated. It's fun. And you know, it's kind of it's information in a beautiful taste. Well, you know, the outdoor sculptural work of the original grounds of the campus were impressive. But I mean, the Andy Goldsworthy Goldsworthy houses in the forest are amazing. The Richard Serra's work, Contour 290, these were fabulous, and they still are. I don't know about you, but that Michael Heiser Room 5 is absolutely a knockout. I mean, you know, we talked about Michael Heiser before on the show, and he really was a star in the late 60s in the land art movement. And then Collapse is the title of the new work on the expanded grounds. Wow. This site-specific commission does me in. It's incredible. It's like worth the trip alone, this one piece. I mean, it's a Waldorf room, and the sky is the ceiling, which I find very beautiful. And there's 15 heavy, rusted steel beams that they appear in this pit, and it's a deep pit. They come out of the pit in places, and they just lean on the sides of the walls of the pit of this walled enclosure. I mean, it sounds a bit creepy, and it is. But, you know, creepy is good in my art world. I mean, there's nothing wrong with creepy. Anyway, viewing this work is not for the soft of heart, as vertigo and a sense of imbalance and I call it reverse acrophobia could set in. Acrophobia is the fear of heights, but in this case, it's the fear of depth.
I have that fear, too.
Yeah, I definitely have that fear. Well, this tremendous work takes place in a new plane, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, the Michael Heiser work is crazy. The guide led me outdoors, and she asked me not to go too close to the edge of this giant square hole. I said, don't worry. I almost grabbed her hand. The scale of it, the depth of the pit, the scale of the beams that looked as though they were dropped there by a giant child playing pickup sticks. And the rusted steel is really handsome and scary at the same time. As in the Heiser slit in the earth, and the earth around the Tony Smith outside the original gallery, the gravel was carefully selected in each case to make the most of the best surroundings for the sculpture. So when you think of the variations of choices in the gravel, you maybe begin to get what I'm talking about, the careful selections. So there's the Louise Bourgeois show that's going on right now in the original Glenstone Gallery. And there's a new piece that I haven't heard yet, and it's a Janet Cardiff sound piece.
Huh.
Oh, I can't wait.
Well, you know, there's always so much going on. That's the other thing. And, you know, the new pavilion building has Cy Twombly sculptures, which I have to say, I didn't even know he did sculptures. He's a really good painter. And then there was Ruth Asawa's woven metal sculptures from the 1950s, and they're in the new galleries. And, you know, this is an artist I wasn't familiar with as well, but the pieces give a sense of tranquility, peace, and spirit in a really elegant way, and they really embellish those new galleries beautifully. The Glenstone has a curatorial program that is kind of assertive in getting the work out there, and they're rotating and expanding the collections.
Yeah, I'd like to explore an interesting contrast between contemporary art, such as this art that we're talking about, and the art of 100 years ago. Heidegger said about that time that art creates a world in the imagination of the viewer. When you look through the frame, for example, of a Cézanne or Bonnard painting, a three-dimensional world is formed in your imagination. This new art doesn't create a world in that way. Instead, it transforms the space of the exhibit. It stuns the viewer, leaves you feeling some force field from the object in front of you has energized the room, the space, and you're included in whatever that field is as you walk around the room. Not quite understanding, but wondering at the strange power. The power of exhibition has been increasing over the past century. This movement began with the exhibition of a urinal. And in fact, this piece by Marcel Duchamp, signed Armut, is here in the museum, very appropriate. And this this approach cultivated shock, confusion, interruption of the habitual as aesthetic values per se, but it's been developing for over a century now, and this museum comes along at this moment and recognizes the power of exhibition. It is a part itself of this movement. The space and the artworks are designed together, and so increase the purity, specificity, and intensity of the experience. So, for example, there's one room contains four pieces by Charles Ray, an 8-foot woman in sort of a trim office fashion, taking a posture of relaxed superiority, like a Greek Athena. A child is playing on the floor, a crushed truck cast in silvery aluminum, and a glass table. Why is that so striking? You can't get it from a picture. A picture gives you no idea of the power in that room. But when you enter that room, it's a feeling of awe, something frightening, as if the room were dreaming. You've entered through a portal into the dream. The selection and placement of the four pieces was revised over and over again by the artist himself. So it's not just four sculptures, each on their own. It's an environment, and it's a large space. And that crushed truck is not a truck. It's an aluminum casting that weighs 12 tons.
Oh, wow. You faked me out there.
Yeah. Think about the logistic nightmare of that placement.
Yes, I also wanted to say that, and that sometimes the galleries are constructed around the work of art or specifically for the work of art. They must have given the contractors heart attacks. Because they had to expand some rooms. There's a beautiful Bryce Martin. It's the first commission piece that Bryce Martin ever did. It is enormous. It's panels that reflect his early work and his present work. And they kept getting bigger while he was working on them. He had to build an extra room onto his studio to house this work as he worked on it. And it's just the only work in the gallery. They put one gallery room just for this painting. It's perfect. So I want to say that this week, these last couple of weeks, have been a terribly painful and emotional week with the ascension of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. So many women are walking around with stricken expressions on their faces. The frustration and disbelief is bombarding me on so many levels. It has brought up unwanted memories myself and also unwanted thoughts. So yesterday, I went down to the museum with my friend. We had planned to do all this before this particular event took place. And on the escalator up to the Sean Scully exhibit, I said, well, this will be a test of the power of art. And strangely enough, for the hour or so, while the whole country was waiting for the votes of a few deciding senators, we were fully engaged, I mean enthusiastically absorbing these paintings, which I'd seen just a few weeks ago. It was wonderful. We felt so restored. We were in a better place. I would say physically, it felt like a weight was lightened. It seemed like my ability to soar beyond the immediate and perhaps, hopefully not, the long-term travesty was a respite, a gift of art. Try it. Make your reservations for Glenstone. So what if it takes a couple of months? You'll be at least, for the time, in a better and necessary world.
Well, thanks for sharing those sentiments, Sheila. Well, the Glenstone is a treasure, and it's out there for all of us. So, Sheila, why don't we tell our listeners about an upcoming show?
Sure. Well, you and I will be putting on a series of shows about the development of an artist and how a visual artist views their success from the beginnings of their art career to the mid-career artist until their late and hopefully productive life in advancing age. This is a very big topic, and we hope to tackle it soon with a series of three shows on how the visual artist sees success.
Well, that show is going to be full of a lot of confession and sticky stuff about what success is in the world these days. But I'd also like to take our listeners to the Textile Museum again, because there's a fantastic show up right now, A Nomad's Art and the Kalims of Anatolia. I never, Sheila, I never met a nomad I didn't like. And these nomadic women are weaving such beautiful stuff. We'll take you there soon. Experience art in the visual and everything you do. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Somewhere over the rainbow. that I heard of once in a chimney tops, that's where